Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
What is going on, Blenders? It is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, and a co-host of the Real Blend podcast, here to introduce you to a bonus episode of the show. Director Renny Harlin, who's coming on to promote his new film, The Strangers, Chapter 1. Now, if you've been paying attention to the news at all, you know that Renny is going to be rebooting the Strangers franchise, but he's setting it up to be a three-part prequel series to the original Strangers. Now, when you see this film, you're going to realize that that's a little bit unusual, because the film sort of plays like a step-by-step sort of remake of the film that starred Liv Tyler and was very popular several years ago. But you'll also see that when you check out The Strangers and listen to my conversation with Renny Harlin, you'll see that there are ways that he approached this franchise that are going to make it very different, and that the way that he's going to explore the mythology moving forward is hopefully going to take it in some really, really strange directions. Now, you guys know me, though. And you know that I'm a huge, huge fan of a different Renny Harlin film, which is his sequel to the original Die Hard, Die Hard 2. And in my opinion, that is, with all due respect to John McTiernan and his Die Hard with a Vengeance, I think Die Hard 2 is the best Die Hard sequel ever created. In fact, I wrote about it in a brand new book I have coming out called Bruce Willis, which is dedicated to his entire filmography. So I was not going to miss the opportunity when talking to Renny Harlin to tell him how much I loved Die Hard 2. And it's really, really heartwarming to hear from him how much that film means to him, and to get some insight into a lot of the conversations and squabbles that he had with Bruce Willis over the direction of that film and the tone and intent of a John McClane story. So that's part of the reason why I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. It's going to be unlike anything that you can see on social media or on YouTube at this time or in a podcast feed, because not only is it Renny Harlin digging into his latest horror film, but it's him going back over his filmography and touching on some of the biggest films he's ever worked on: Cliffhanger, The Long Kiss Goodnight, and of course, he and I take a deep, deep dive into Die Hard 2. So this is Renny Harlin, director of The Strangers Chapter 1, only here on the Real Blend podcast. Well, I'll try to give you a few that hopefully you haven't heard on this press tour. So,
all right.
And I want to start here with the concept of claustrophobia, because there are a number of times throughout this movie where I, as the audience member, literally felt claustrophobic. And I think it's because of where you put your camera and how you frame your action. And I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about using your camera to create that feeling of claustrophobia and that tension.
I already love you, Sean. It's really fun when people like observe things, analyze things, and realize, well, it takes a real professional, I think, to like understand or appreciate it, that the filmmaker is actually like trying to do something, and it's not just like random, like stuff happens and we just try to record it on film. So whether it's so evident in my movies or not, it depends, I'm sure, on the viewer, but I do design things very, very carefully. And I try to storyboard as much as possible. I always shortlist everything beforehand. I think of the whole arc of the movie, and in this case, arc of three movies, of how the visual language develops and how we put the audience in the movie, how we make the audience relate to the characters and feel like they are with the characters and experiencing what the characters are experiencing. And so in this case, I felt that the use of wide lenses was going to serve us the best, which, whether we are in the forest or we are in the house, when you go close to the actor with a wide lens, if you want to get a close-up of the actor, you could, of course, do it with a long lens and you look beautiful. But with a wide lens, you really include the environment around them, and then depending on the camera height and the lighting and what you choose to have in the background, you can then lead the audience's thoughts into whatever you want. And so in this case, I think the claustrophobia and the general feeling of dread and threat comes from the fact that the lens shows you the room behind the character. Let's say she's playing the piano, you know, but you can see the whole room and you can see the staircase and all these things. And you automatically start your mind without you even realizing it. You start thinking like, what if somebody started coming down those stairs? What if there was somebody in that corner? And so that's the wide lenses is definitely one thing. And then where you place the camera, sometimes you place the camera behind the actor and you create the feeling of, you know, turn around, look this way. You know, the camera is here, so obviously there must be something here, so you should check it out. It's not safe. And then shooting through things, windows, bookcases, putting things on the foreground, which or the balustrade of the staircase, you automatically start thinking that it's like a voyeuristic POV and somebody is looking at them. So it is carefully designed, and you know, if it works, fantastic. But there's not a single instance where the camera, which it just fell down there and then we just shot. But it's the camera height, the angles, the camera movement, all that is very carefully designed.
I think you're having a lot of fun when you put your main character at the front door, because you sort of pivot to look up and you show enough of the door that every time you did it, I was convinced an axe handle was coming through that front door.
Yeah, that's great. And it's interesting because you want to lead and mislead the audience. Like, you want them to anticipate something like that. And at the same time, you want to be able to surprise them and not telegraph everything. And which, you know, since you talk about that, I also want to mention the importance of music and sound, because sometimes music and sometimes you don't really find out that until you're in the final mixing stage of the movie, you're in the sound studio, you're mixing all the sound effects and the dialogue and the music together. And you watch a scene and the composer has done a wonderful score that goes through all the scenes and it's scary and all that. But then you realize that sometimes the music actually telegraphs to the audience that, okay, this is scary and something bad is about to happen.
Sure.
And so, especially with this movie, sometimes I just drop the music out and played it with sound effects and realized that it was much scarier not to... The music almost, in a weird way, gives like a safety net to the audience. They're like, okay, the music is telling me how to feel, but it's music, so it's a movie, so it's safe. But then when there's no music, you're like, you're faced with the naked reality of the scene and the situation, and it actually makes your skin crawl in a whole different way.
Well, Rennie, to that point, I also want to talk about lighting, because there are times when you... seemingly rely on the lighting that's cast from like an iPhone, right? But I'm assuming you're enhancing that, because the light is telling us where to look, but it's not until you're on set and realizing how much light is being thrown that you probably have to adjust that. Because can you talk about on set when you start to figure out what your lighting is going to capture and what it isn't?
Yeah, it's a tricky thing, because it's like, you know, you want it to feel... this type of movie, you know, most of it happening at night, you want it to be as dark as possible. But darkness, if you just have the lights off and you film it, it's just black. So you have to highlight things and create the sort of movie reality of darkness. And it's a very subtle thing that, you know, only really good DPs can do and make it look so that it looks beautiful. But it looks real, and that it's dark enough to give you the mystery of, you know, what might be there. You can't really see it, but at the same time, some definition in the frame so that it's not just a black hole. And definitely, whether it's candlelight or flashlight or iPhone light, we have to enhance it. And it's just not enough to because you it's different if you're making a sort of a you know, kind of a found footage film or something where the images can be really gritty and grainy and all that. But this I wanted this to feel like a major movie, like have a real cinematic experience. So you have to enhance the light in all the scenes.
And I'm really curious, are you a director who uses multiple takes, or do you like to get as quick as you can and move?
You know, I would say that maybe in the beginning of my career, I did more takes, maybe partially because I thought that something magical was going to happen if I do more takes, or maybe I was insecure. But I learned that my philosophy is, and of course there are different kinds of directors, but my philosophy is that if it's scene is rehearsed properly, you know exactly where you want your camera, where you want to stage your actors and how you want things to happen, and you rehearse it, then you get the best and freshest and most real takes in the beginning. Of course, there are different kinds of actors also who need maybe more, but I love to just do two takes and move on. And also what I've discovered is that, you know, sometimes, you know, and it can be like a complex shot with certain camera move and maybe some kind of special effects there, or, you know, dripping blood, whatever it might be. And you do that second take and everybody's like, oh my God, that was perfect. And then somebody says like, should we just do one more just for safety? It's like, safety, why do you need a safety take? But I made that mistake earlier in my career. And what I learned is that if you fall into that trap of let's do just one more for safety, then the next take goes completely wrong. Like the camera falls off the dolly. Next day, the light falls down. Next day, the actor stumbles. Next take, they forget the dialogue. And it's like 14 takes later. Now you can't give up anymore. Now you can't go back and say like, you know, actually, you know, the second take was so good. Like, let's just stop now. No, now you have to get that perfect take and you're trapped. You know,
crazy. Real. So you are no stranger, no pun intended, to stepping into horror franchises that already have a bit of an established world, whether it be it's 20 years ago that you stepped into the Exorcist series, obviously Nightmare on Elm Street early in your career. What do you enjoy about building off of existing threads in a horror saga? And how do you like to kind of put your own fingerprints on the material?
Well, in the case of Nightmare on Elm Street, it was really... it was another movie that I really randomly saw. I remember I was in London and just like saw the poster outside a movie theater and went to see it. And I was just blown away. I loved it because I've had nightmares all my life. So I could really relate to it. And so when the opportunity came, I was still, you know, I was like 27 or something. I'd just come to Hollywood and I was just desperate to work. And then the opportunity came to do Nightmare on Elm Street 4. I just felt like I get this. I know what this is, and I love these movies, and I think there's something that I can contribute. So it was a very natural thing. Exorcist is, you know, we would need to do a whole another interview just about that, because that was a very weird situation where literally a producer who's a friend of mine asked me to do a favor and to just kind of like help a little bit with a movie that they felt was troubled. And I just out of my good heart, I said like, okay, I'll see if I can help a little bit. And it just like turned into kind of redoing the whole movie. So it was a very unusual situation. And I don't regret it because I did it for a friend, but I regret it in a sense that I would never touch The Exorcist. I think that it's such holy ground that to me there's almost like no point in you know redoing it or something like that. But what I've learned about this opportunity is where like if we talk about action movies, I did Die Hard 2, is that you really owe it to the audience to give them the basic experience that they so enjoyed in the original. That's like the most important thing. You have to be faithful to the audience, to the fans. You can't just go on your own ego trip and just do your own thing and say like, oh, I can do this better. But you don't want to copy. Obviously, the audience doesn't want to see the same thing again. So I call it replicating the experience, not copying, but replicating the experience. So you get the basic setup, you get the basic characters, you get the basic atmosphere of that particular franchise. And then you do your best to give the audience something more so that it's really, definitely, it's not about copying it, but it's living in that world, but giving the audience something more. And I just think about myself of like, okay, I love this movie. In this case, I love the original Strangers. So how do I create a three movie epic that as a jumping off board uses the premise of this beloved movie, but then takes us on another journey that feels honest and real in that world, but it's its own beast.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
I want to come back around to chapters 2 and 3 in a second, but I have to detour here. I have a book coming out on June 11th, and it's about Bruce Willis and his career, a celebration of his filmography. And I have to tell you that Die Hard 2, in my opinion, is the only true Die Hard sequel. It's the only one that legitimately feels like the original film, the original McTiernan, because it's limited to one location. It's McClane fighting for the love of his family. Like, from Vengeance, with a Vengeance on, he's a disgruntled drunk who doesn't really, he's not connected to his family. Like, the fact that the McClane is fighting to save his family is to me what the connection of the familial roots of the first one, and keeping him limited to a location where he can't leave, he can't go too far away from it, has always been why I argue that Die Hard 2 is the best sequel in the franchise.
Thank you. And I couldn't agree with you more. I don't want to put down anybody else's movies, and that's not my intention. But I think that that's exactly what I was talking about, replicating the experience, which you so intelligently analyze it. It's the environment. It's that he's forced into this thing. And more than anything, it's about the family. It's about his wife. It's like, I get goosebumps when I talk about this, because like you're so, you know, you're hitting the nail right on the head that this was one of the well, there were two disagreements I had with Bruce when doing that. One was that he had just become a movie star. He had done moonlighting for 20 years, but now he had become a movie star. And he was hell-bent on making Die Hard 2 a serious movie, like a real dramatic, serious action drama. And I spent countless days of just talking to him about replicating the experience. The audience loves your blue-collar cop who is in love with his wife, had the problems originally, but is now in love with his wife, and is an everyman, and has a sarcastic sense of humor. Sure. That's the character the audience loves. And you can now just like say, like, he doesn't crack any jokes anymore. He's just serious. It's like, that was one big disagreement. And the second one was regarding the family. And like, well, I don't want to, you know, go too deep into personal opinions and things, but he was not so convinced that this family aspect was so important in the second.
And it's integral. It's integral to his character.
I kept telling him and everybody around is that the whole point why this movie will work is that he is not saving the world from a nuclear disaster. He's saving his wife.
Yes.
And for the course of it, he's saving all these other people, and he's an incredible hero. But why is he really so hell-bent and desperate and passionate about what he's doing? Is because his wife is there. It's about the wife. And that's why when they finally get together in the end and they hug, it's like, that's it. It's not about like, yeah, we avoided a nuclear disaster. And actually, when you think about it, like very few movies nowadays do this, because it like you take any giant action movie, it's like people are just always like racking their brain, like what are they going to do? They're going to spread anthrax everywhere in the universe, or you know, it's the biggest nuclear weapon that is going to blow up the whole universe, and that kind of stuff, or it's a meteorite that is going to destroy the world. But you know, when you can make it about the characters and people root for them and relate to them, that's gold. And I had to fight for some of the scenes, like and this, you know, it's an example of a scene that works because it's emotionally so strong that it works, and the audience doesn't stop to think about the reality of it really. And it's when they talk to each other via phone. Bruce is on a payphone and she's on kind of an airphone in the, on the plane, which, you know, I guess today you could do anything, but in those days it's like a complete impossibility. But the audience, because it was emotionally so important that they connect, and so that movie is all about, and ever since I did that, it's like I always tell screenwriters and producers and studio executives, I always say emotion, emotion, emotion. In every movie, it's about the emotion. You can blow up everything and you can have all the action and the car chases and everything, but if you don't have emotion that the audience can relate to, and you know, I mean, let's look at the first John Wick that started the franchise. It's all about, you know, his ex-wife and about his dog. And that's the driving force for the whole movie.
In
thanks for
fact,
saying, like,
I
you
get
know.
bored by the later ones because it's just a relentless killing machine. You know, I more
Well,
want to see a
I didn't
vulnerable
want
hero. No, listen, this is me.
to, I
Those are
didn't want to
good
say anything.
movies. Those are good movies, but they get away from what makes these stories special.
Which I'm, you know, I mean, who am I to criticize people who are making billions of dollars with these movies? But now that you say it, I feel exactly like you. Like when I watch these movies, I'm like, okay, yes, there's like 200 million spent with unbelievable, incredible action and all that, fantastic style and all that. But like, where's the emotion? Now it's just a revenge story. I'm not even sure I know anymore why he's going after all these people. But there's like zero emotional stakes involved anymore. Even, you know, like you look at Bond movies, recent Bond movies, there's been some really high emotional stakes, and which I think is beautiful. So I think that it doesn't matter if we're talking about action or horror or any kind of a movie, you gotta have emotion. They're coming to the movie theater to feel something and not just feel like, which is of course the case in some studio movies, emotion is replaced by spectacle. You know, you have CG everywhere, everything, car chases and flying people and everything. And so it's like you've come now to see a circus instead of seeing a play where, you know, you're rooting for the characters and emotionally really, really involved. So
Rennie, there's a reason why at the end of your massive explosion at Die Hard 2, you had Bruce Willis say, "There's your fucking landing light." Like, it was everything he's doing is to get his wife on the ground safely. That's it. That's it.
absolutely, absolutely.
All right,
Thank
let's
you.
get back to the strangers, please. I cannot wrap my brain around the fact that I think you shot all three of these like back to back. This seems epic in scope and probably a bad idea.
I wish it was back to back. That would have made it simple. But it was really on top of each other because there are certain locations that all three movies share in certain ways. The house and the forest and certain places, though the next two movies do take us to completely, you know, different journey, but still some sets were shared. And so the only sensible way to shoot a movie economically is to, like, you know, once you're in the house, you're going to shoot everything that happens in the house ever in this 4.5 hour epic journey. And so we're going from Monday morning, we are doing movie three, Monday afternoon, movie one, Tuesday morning, movie two. And the challenge for, you know, for me, it's easier, though I still, you know, have to really keep in mind, like, what's the tempo? What's the tension? Where's the threat? How much does the audience know at this point? All that stuff, of course, and how I shoot it and how I direct the actors. But for actors to be emotionally in the right place, and for the crew from production design to props to costume design to makeup, literally, Madsy's character could be covered in blood with torn clothes and barely able to walk on Monday morning. And 2 hours later, she's completely clean and pristine, driving in the car and admiring a nice little town, and all life ahead of her. And then and when you think about it, like even in one movie, because movies are always shot out of order.
Sure.
Even one movie, like in a horror film, you have to really carefully design the emotional levels of, you know, the fear and the horror. And let's say that you are, you know, shooting the first scary scene first, and you can easily sort of like put everything into it, like, oh my God, she's going to be so horrified and she's going to be so frightened, and then she's going to be there alone, and then tears are going to start falling down her cheeks and all this stuff. Yeah, makes sense. But then you have to keep in mind there's still 90 minutes of horror to come. So we have to keep building, and she can be crying in every scene, and she can be screaming in every scene and look scared every scene. Sometimes, you know, the levels have to change, let alone with three movies. Like, we had literally like emotion charts and crying charts to make sure that we don't fall into a trap that when you cut it all together, it's like she's just going from like, what, the next scene, again, it's like there just has to be a pace and build up and some kind of rhyme and reason to all of it. But yeah, for every department, it was the challenge of a lifetime to always remember where we are. And it affected, you know, of course, our shooting style and lighting style, everything. And then once it was shot, then the edit, same thing with the editing. Like, I designed the visual language, hopefully it all works, so that it develops from the first movie to the second movie and the third movie. And the movies kind of get more and more epic, bigger scale. But at the same time, you know, even if we are in the you know, vast wilderness at some point, still keeping that, like you mentioned, that claustrophobia and that feeling like anything could be anywhere, anytime, and nothing is safe. So yeah, then in the editing room, we've discovered that some things work great and some things we had to work on to make the transition smooth and all that. So it's, you know, you make, even if you just make one movie, you make it three times. When you're scripting it and you're in pre-production, you design one movie. And then when you're shooting, because of all the things that affects your work and days and nights, it becomes another movie. And then in the editing room, you take all that and then it takes a life of its own and it becomes a new movie. And in this case, three movies.
Well, I'll get you out of here on this one. Then, of those three phases, which one do you prefer? And has that changed over the course of your career?
Excellent question. I wish I had a simple answer, but I would say I love prep, because in prep you can dream anything. You know, I draw a lot of storyboards and I do a lot of research. I watch other movies. I watch photography and art and anything that can inspire me. So it's a really fun phase, because you can dream anything, you can do anything, and it doesn't cost anything. So you can dream as big and crazy as possible, and then you will present those dreams to producers and financiers, and then you'll see what you can actually do. But that's like the freest time, the prep, and also, you know, finding locations. And I also, like, my philosophy is that, like, I tell always production designers and location scouts, it's like, If the you know, script says like interior warehouse and then blah, 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 blah happens, I'm like, okay, we are in this town, you know, and I haven't been here before. But when you start looking for locations, don't just look for warehouses. You might have a fantastic church, or you might have something completely different, a cave. Like, just present everything to me, because I don't care what the script says. I'll just go for whatever visually I think, you know, works best for the movie.
Sure.
The really fun time. But I must say, now that I'm talking, the funnest time for me is on the set, because I'll be completely honest with you. Since I was a kid, I just was the type always who kind of naturally was the leader. Like when kids, neighborhood kids would get together and, you know, go and play whatever, I would be the one who would say like, okay, we're going to do this. And you guys are this, and you guys are the bad guys. You guys are the good guys. And then we're going to do this, and we're going to go there. So it just came naturally to me. And it is the greatest feeling. It's the greatest high I know in life is when I'm on the set and there's at least 200-400 people there of crew and cast who are just listening to every one of my words. And of course, we prep the movie together. But now I am there. Everybody's waiting for me to walk in and say, okay, actors, I want you to do this. And then, you know, let's see if, you know, you come in from there, you come in from there, and then you talk and then you turn and da-da. Of course, I'm not telling them every step, but I have a very clear idea what I think the actors will do in that space. And then we rehearse that. And then I tell like, okay, and the camera is going to start from here and then do this. And then we're going to have this angle. And then we're going to have that reverse. And then we're going to have an insert of this. And everybody's just like, okay, let's do it. And of course, there's, you know, tons of input from all the people, the actors and the crew, and they just make me look smarter and better every day. But it is, but I am in charge, and it is just the greatest high. It's just like, I think that there's at least a good fraction of feeling the same that a rock star feels when they are on stage.
Yeah,
you know, sure. Mick Jagger is on stage in front of 80,000 people, and every move he makes, every word he says, he can get the reaction from the audience. Whatever he wants, it will happen, and he knows it. And it's a little bit of that I feel like I'm a rock star when I'm on the set, and whatever I say, people will be like, "Yeah, let's do it." and it's that's when I'm alive, and like my wife says the same thing. It's like I get like little antsy at home, and she's like, "Don't worry, you'll be on the set soon." And that's when I'm alive.
That's amazing. Rennie, this was an honor. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Hope I hit you with a few you hadn't heard yet.
You absolutely did it. Well, you see how like into it I got. It's like you inspired me. Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much.
Terrific. I appreciate your time. Talk to you soon. Good luck.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
We have to thank our good friend Rennie Harlan for coming on to the show. He had such kind words to say about the interview and about the questions. You guys know how much that means to us when we hear a subject being really happy about the questions that they're getting asked, especially on a junketeur when they're getting inundated with, you know, the same types of questions. So to hit him out of the gate with, you know, legitimate storytelling questions and to get really technical and to get into his process was a thrill, you know, but it's not going to hold a candle to being able to talk Die Hard 2 with the man who made Die Hard 2 and to really dig into his collaborations with Bruce Willis. You think I'm exaggerating? I legitimately wrote a chapter in my Bruce Willis book about Die Hard 2 versus Die Hard with a Vengeance. You can hear my thoughts or read my thoughts about what I think about the Die Hard franchise in my brand new book, Cheap Plug, Bruce Willis. It is available right now for pre-order. It comes onto the stands on June 11th. So now that you've listened to Rennie Harlan and myself gush about why Die Hard 2 is the best sequel of the franchise, you can agree with me or disagree with me in the comments down below. You know I want to hear from you guys, you Die Hard maniacs. Let me know why I'm right or wrong, and I promise to play along with you guys in the comments. As long as you're nice, be nice. Don't be rude about this. Rennie Harlan's film, The Strangers, Chapter 1, is coming to theaters. Make sure that you circle it. I think the release dates for Chapters 2 and 3 are really close behind it. I'm not sure that they've been confirmed, but as you heard in the interview, he kind of shot these back-to-back or relatively close to each other and consecutively, so I think he's going to try and work on getting these films into theaters and to the audiences as quickly as possible. When you get to the end of this film, you're going to realize that there's like a cliffhanger that's pushing the narrative forward. So you're going to want to find out where it's going next. Thank you to Rennie for coming on. And thank you guys for checking out the latest Real Blend. Make sure you are checking out all the rest of our interviews. We have a deep, deep catalog of old interviews to be found on our channel. Whether you're listening in audio form, or if you happen to be on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast, you can see video interviews with some of your favorite directors and talent. And next week, we have a huge one coming. George Miller, the director of Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, is going to be sitting down with the three Real Blend hosts to dissect his filmography and his approach to the new movie. So you do not want to miss George Miller on Real Blend when that drops. Until then, enjoy your time out there, movie lovers. Share the channel with a friend, and we will talk to you guys soon.